Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. A new study finds Americans have fewer friends and are lonelier than a couple of decades ago. It's the age of Oprah, email, MySpace, and TV shows about friends, but apparently all this public emoting and electronic communing doesn't help us forge the kind of relationships we need most. The new research finds that in the past 20 years, the average number of people in which Americans confide has dropped from 3 to 2, and that a quarter of Americans have no close friends at all. Sociologists say it's the latest evidence of the fraying fabric of American community, thanks perhaps to longer commutes, two-career families, maybe even too much TV. It's a troubling trend because social isolation is linked to such problems as crime, poor health, not to mention unhappiness. Up next on Point, the increasingly lonely American. And joining me now from Durham, North Carolina, is Lynn Smith Lovin, professor of sociology at Duke University and co-author of a new study on loneliness entitled Social Isolation in America, published last week in the American Sociological Review. And Lynn Smith Lovin, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us today.
Hello, Anthony.
I really appreciate having you. Flesh out, if you would, just to kick it off, what your study found. The headline is the average American has fewer close friends in which they can confide, that there are more Americans without any close friends. What did you find? Flesh that out for us.
Well, you're right that the big change was in those numbers that you've already quoted. But we also found some really interesting shifts in the kinds of relationships that people had with their core discussion partners, the people with whom they really discussed important matters, things that were personally important to them. You mentioned two career families. We actually found that spouses were one of the few bright spots here. Mm. The spouses actually went up in the degree to which they talked to each other about important matters.
Now, is that a result of the fact that there are fewer close friends, so it's natural that people will turn to their spouses and partners?
Yes. Our study doesn't speak directly to why this change occurred, but if we're right that it has something to do with more hours in the paid labor force, longer commutes, suburbs and exurbs, probably people are having less of a chance to socialize with coworkers or with neighbors or things like that. And so when they get home, they talk to their partner or spouse. Mm.
How do the numbers break down along lines of gender, class, race, and so on? In other words, which Americans seem to be the most lonely?
Well, the gender story is interesting because we find that women are still the kin keepers. They still have more connections to – close connections to family members. But men and women have gotten more similar in the types and numbers of contacts outside the family. And we'd like to say that women are catching up with men, but actually it was the reverse, that the men have lost contacts outside the family, and so they are sort of falling down to the level that used to be typical of women. Hmm. But this business of talking to partners is really interesting because that's actually put men and women in more contact with somebody of the other sex because, of course, in our society, your partners – your spouse, at least, is somebody of the other sex.
Interesting. Now, the idea, the rise of social isolation in America, the discussion of this is not a new phenomenon. Robert Putnam of Harvard, of course, several years ago, famously described this idea in his book Bowling Alone, which talks about the fraying social fabric of American communities. Some were skeptical about Putnam's theories. It seems as though, I'm not sure if you counted yourself among the skeptics, but it seems as though your research backs him up.
Yes, my co-author Miller McPherson, who's also a professor of sociology here at Duke, has been doing work on the interrelationship of people's networks and their participation in these face-to-face neighborhood groups for about 3 decades. And we didn't see the trends as quite as simple in one way as Bob Putnam has often talked about them, but our recent data definitely support his ideas. There are fewer ties through neighborhoods and through co-membership and voluntary groups. And in another study that we're doing now, we did find that voluntary association membership is down a bit as well.
Hmm. And of course, just for people who aren't familiar with Bob Putnam's work, bowling alone, sort of the idea of bowling alone, neighborhood bowling leagues were actually drying up and shutting down because fewer people were participating in that kind of activity as a kind of representative of what's kind of symbol of what's going on. Can we talk a little bit about the forces that are driving us apart? We've sort of touched on them, the idea of suburbia, longer commute, two-car families. What do you think's really behind this data?
Well, if I had to put my finger on one factor that I think is important, it would be the fact that the average American family has adults spending many more hours in the paid labor force. Mm-hmm. Actually, individuals are working fewer hours, but families are much more likely to have both partners working. Women have moved from part-time to full-time work. Some people are doing two jobs to make ends meet. And so I think the combination of more work and probably a bigger separation between work and geographic location of the home is probably the big thing that's happening here.
And do you come at this, and I want to sort of get into this later in the hour, but before we bring in some other voices into this conversation, what's the solution to this? What do you see as the solution?
Well, Miller McPherson's work has shown over a long period of time that people make these kind of contacts, especially contacts outside the family, in face-to-face groups that meet in the community where you really see somebody repeatedly over a fairly long period of time and have a chance to develop a relationship with them. And so I would say to people, think about how you spend your time and who you spend time with, because you aren't going to talk about important matters, matters that are personally important to you, unless you see somebody on a regular basis and spend some time with them in some kind of social context that brings you together on a regular basis.
Mm. Well, speaking of that, I want to bring in another voice into this conversation. With me in the studio, and she's been here listening to the conversation, is Jacqueline Olds. She's a psychiatrist at Harvard Medical School and co-author with her husband, Richard Schwartz, of the book Overcoming Loneliness in Everyday Life, which was published in 1996. And Jacqueline Olds, thanks for coming in. It's good to have you here.
My pleasure.
So you've been listening. Chime in here. Excuse me. You wrote your book Overcoming Loneliness in Everyday Life 10 years ago about what you called an epidemic of loneliness. Why do you believe it's becoming more widespread?
Well, I certainly agree with what Lynn said in terms of more people working. And in a way, the more productivity you've got in a whole family in terms of work, the less time there is for people to think of what feels like luxuries, namely connecting with friends. It's also probably true that maintaining a nuclear family and two jobs is already a huge mission for most families.
Hmm. And what about this? I'm sorry, you're about to add something.
I was just going to say, that the additional part of connecting with friends, it feels, again, like a luxury.
But, you know, and maybe this is sort of the cliche, but I'm sort of struck by this, and we refer to it in the opening of the show. We're living in this time when everyone is so immediately connected to each other with email and web and the internet and so on and so forth. Does that help or hurt? I mean, is that one of the reasons why we're sort of seem to be drifting apart from each other? Because there's this sort of surrogate idea of closeness that might not be providing the closeness that we need.
Well, it's probably a symptom of everybody having so much less time for things like visiting or even talking on the telephone. Mm-hmm. The thing about email is you can do it in 2 minutes between two supposedly productive tasks, and you don't have to give much energy to socializing.
Hmm.
And so there is a cost, but there is help in some ways because it keeps people from dropping completely out of contact.
And what's your, best prescription? What's the solution for this?
Well, in our book, we talk about something called the shared task, that basically if people engineer their lives so they have a joint mission or a joint task, and it can be as simple as a carpool, and it can be as complicated as a, babysitting cooperative, but it allows people to get into regular contact, just like Lynn said. And if you see people in a regular way over time, you start to feel close.
Does that make sense to you, Lynn Smith Lovin? I mean, is it that? I mean, it sounds like we're talking about this isn't a big issue like global warming that has sort of a how do we solve this problem? These solutions sound relatively local and within our grasp.
Yes, I'm right with Jacqueline here. The idea of a shared task is really a focus of activity that leads people to be together. I'm really struck by the fact that her book 10 years ago was with her husband, and Miller McPherson is my husband. And so we're great examples of how, you know, if you have a busy work life and you don't have enough time to spend together on just relaxing things, then sharing a work task can be one way to enjoy each other and to keep closeness. Other people, of course, may not be as lucky as we are to be able to share these intellectual and scholarly issues with a spouse. But sharing something that brings you together on a regular basis and maybe accomplishes something at the same time is an excellent focus.
Jackie Olds, the idea of sharing something like that is important.
I think it is, and I just wanted to mention that we even had a contact outside the family because we had a third author on that book, Harriet Webster. So we made a friend.
So you had friends, you had family, you had it all covered. Let's go right to some calls. We've got a lot of callers backed up already who are ready to chime in on this conversation. Let's go to Jane, who's calling from Plattsburgh, New York. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I just had one observation. In the suburban communities, nobody builds back front porches anymore. There's all these houses built with these beautiful back decks, but no one has a front porch. So it's I think that's evidence of what's going on here.
And do you feel that, are you seeing that in your community? I mean, do you long for the kind of front porch culture and people coming out and making contact with each other on a more informal basis?
Well, I actually live within a city neighborhood, but I noticed that these suburban communities going up, you always see these big houses with these beautiful back decks, and I don't notice it so much here living in an old neighborhood
right. Within
the city, so I'm pretty close with my neighbors. We see them walking by, and, in these suburban communities, there's no store.
Yeah.
There's not too much passerbys.
Okay, got it, Jane. Thanks so much for that idea. Lynn Smith Lovin, what do you think of Jane's idea? I mean, it is sort of part of the American ethos to kind of create our own castle and our own sort of sense of personal space, often behind our house, just as Jane is talking about.
I think she's right that the sort of ecology and design of our communities does make a big difference. I live in Durham in an older neighborhood with lovely front porches and their children drawing hopscotch on the sidewalks in front of us. And it has a very, very nice feel to it. But we found in the survey that many fewer of the discussion partners and people with whom we discuss important matters come from our neighborhoods now.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. And Jackie Olds, maybe you can chime in on this. And this idea of opportunities to create more casual social interaction that a front porch might suggest. Does that get at the problem, or is this problem something more deeper that runs deeper than that?
I think it's a deeper problem because people who have front porches have so little time to rock back and forth on the front porch.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember reading in Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, that he talked about talking with the government about giving tax credits to people who would build front porches. Because if you have the structure there, it's more likely to be used. And you don't want to have nuclear families kind of retreating unto themselves.
Let's go to Alex, who's calling from Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Anthony. How's it going?
Very well. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm just thinking that people, they just think that they're so lonely. I mean, you talked about MySpace earlier, and I have a MySpace. I have 300 or more friends, and people just think they write all these crazy subjects like, oh, my gosh, I have no friends. I'm so lonely. And people, I think they're just craving attention because they really want more care for them. And I agree with Jane on the whole suburbs thing. And people, whether they know it or not, they build back porches and less front porches. And
yeah.
In my neighborhood, we don't even have a sidewalk.
Interesting. So. Alex, can I ask how old you are? Are you
I'm 15.
You're 15.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So basically, you disagree with the sort of thrust of the study, and you think this is more about craving attention as opposed to needing more close friendships.
Yes, in adolescence, definitely, yes.
Interesting idea. Lynn Smith-Levin, do you want to talk to Alex about his skepticism about the findings? What do you make of what Alex has to say?
Well, I think that he's right that we may be becoming connected in different ways. I want to emphasize that we only studied this one kind of relationship, people with whom you discuss important matters. But it's definitely the case that people are connected to many more people over email and internet and things like that. And I know people who have hundreds of friends on MySpace, and but that's a different kind of relationship. And so it could be that society as a whole is moving toward a different kind of connection with a larger set of people that you have a more unidimensional relationship with. Mm.
I'm wondering, and I'd like you both to chime in on this. Let me start with you, Jacqueline Olds, and that is, does this culture suffer a little bit from sort of conflicting messages about loneliness? I mean, on the one hand, we embrace a kind of confessional nature in this society as characterized by the Oprah program and so on. On the other hand, we're a culture that embraces personal strength and individuality. I mean, do these forces sort of collide and create a sense of confusion about the whole idea of loneliness?
Absolutely. I think, in fact, that Americans are so wanting to be self-sufficient and sort of not lean too much on each other the way they may associate with the old country, that they sometimes paint themselves into a bit of a lonely corner. And whereas some neighborhoods you occasionally find where people are kind of knit together by, potluck associations and things, there are other neighborhoods where people wouldn't want to ask their next-door neighbor a favor because it would hurt their pride. Hmm. And I think that's a sort of terrible trend.
Let's go to Karen, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell us what's on your mind.
Well, I'm 37 years old. I have been battling loneliness for about 20 years with some great efforts. Hmm. And I find that my friends just don't have the same priorities, really. I have never owned a television ever since moving out of my parents' house, so I'm not, bound to see what happens on the next episode. I've always lived within 15 minutes of work so that I don't spend hours commuting. I try to find apartments or homes nearby work. And I used to cook dinner weekly for friends, but now I just get too many rejections. They're too busy.
Mm.
And I just find it to be such a top priority to keep in touch with my friends and keep these friendships going. And it's disheartening because they're not finding the same priority.
So and so your analysis of the problem is just it's as simple as just too many people are too busy.
Yes, and I think, too, that they just have different priorities than I do. I don't think you have to go to every event that comes into town. I don't think you have to go to every sporting event. I think it's okay to stay at home and be neighborly. And I think people just want to fill their schedules with events.
Mm, okay, Karen, thanks a lot. Jackie Olds, what do you make of what Karen is saying? I mean, in a way, we sort of touched on this, but this idea of just we are a busy society and that inevitably takes a bite out of friendships.
Well, my own personal theory about the cult of busyness is that everybody tries to pretend that they're super busy so they won't have to acknowledge or admit that they might be lonely.
Mm.
And that it's a sort of, if you can say you've been to three or four events, nobody might suspect that you're actually lonely.
And that gets Lynn Smith-Levin to the idea of the sort of stigma, the negative stigma of loneliness. I mean, is that a problem that you think about? And I don't know if your research sort of shows up anything on this, but it's hard for Americans to say, I'm lonely.
I think that would probably be more Jacqueline's domain than mine. But I think Karen's absolutely right that relationships do take work. And just going to an event where you're part of a crowd is probably not going to create the kind of long-duration, high-frequency of interaction kinds of patterns that we found were typical of these close confidants. A better strategy might be to go to groups that actually meet face-to-face in your community on a regular basis and, as Jacqueline was saying earlier, have a shared task that they're trying to accomplish.
Hmm. Jacqueline, what about this idea that I put to Lynn, and that is this idea of the stigma of loneliness? How does this play into this dynamic?
Well, as psychiatrists, we find that people who are lonely don't even tell us for sometimes a month or two.
Hmm.
that they would rather present, you know, depressive symptoms than acknowledge that they don't have enough people in their life. So I think there is a huge stigma.
Let me bring in another voice into the conversation, Bernice Pesco-Solido. She's a medical sociologist at Indiana University and director of the Indiana Consortium for Mental Health Services. And Dr. Pesco-Solido, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Tony.
Let me ask you about this, and we wanted to bring you into the section of the show where we want to talk about the impact of loneliness on our health and well-being. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, obviously, loneliness in itself, it doesn't make people happy, it makes people unhappy, but the health effects could go beyond that.
Oh, absolutely. I think we've known for a very long time. In the 70s, I think it was a bit of a surprise, but since then, we've known that not having the kind of strong, supportive, and diverse friendship ties that Lynn has been talking about, not having those has been implicated in everything from coronary heart disease to depression to diabetes, cancer, suicide, and asthma. Even the common cold seems to be related to not having the kinds of diverse and supportive ties that that Lynn has been talking about.
Really? So it's that direct. I mean, this is actually based on evidence that loneliness, for example, offers the kind of risk that, say, smoking might.
Oh, even worse. I mean, the research from the 80s shows that social isolation is a more important factor of getting sick or dying than smoking, which I think surprises a lot of Americans because we've very much demonized smoking, while, as you talked about, the stigma of loneliness seems to be something that we want to put in the background. Mm-hmm. And, I think Alex was right on target when he talked about the issue of people, how they have friendships now. And I think there's no better example than to watch college students always having a cell phone to their ear because they don't want to appear lonely. They don't want to appear that they're not connected somehow. And ironically, that kind of connection stops them from building more new ties that could become those long-term friends.
Interesting. Is there an important distinction, though, that we need to keep in mind between loneliness and making a choice to be alone? Let me ask you, Jacqueline Olds, about that.
Well, when people make a choice to be alone, they don't mind it.
Yeah.
And the word lonely implies that somehow being alone has moved into loneliness where they do mind it. Now, in the mental health world, we don't always know whether too much loneliness then leads to depression or whether loneliness might be the early phase of depression.
Mm-hmm.
But we do know that part of why therapy is an important factor in getting people jump-started back to feeling better is because it makes a connection and then it has a ripple effect, and they start to make more connections. But being alone has always been an important factor in being a human being.
Anne is calling from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hello, Anne.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
This is actually my topic, and it's my topic that I have trouble getting my friends to have any further tolerance with, and that is I got my breast cancer back metastatically, and actually it's easier to deal with that than it is to deal with the loneliness.
Wow.
So people say, oh, you're depressed, and I go, no, I'm not depressed. I am lonely. By which I don't mean I don't have some wonderful friends, but in my life as a whole, I am usually by myself. I go and I make contacts or people do call me, but on the whole, my life is, even though I moved to a different town to be involved with some civic affairs and things like that, and then I got sick and I really couldn't do it as much anymore, but on the whole, I have to explain what happened in my life to people as opposed to being there sharing what happened in my life with people.
And what's your theory as to why, Anne? Why do you feel that? I mean, it sounds like you're outgoing and you want people in your life. Why aren't they there?
I think that people who are, my friends who are divorced are working more than one job and usually still have child care or older parent care. I had that issue. And a lot of the nuclear families are very healthy because they're spending so much time together. So somehow or other, if you are the single person, you're kind of like, I've lived in two different towns with front porches, and to me, they're wonderful, but they don't get that closeness going that I would really like. And I do have my close friends, but on a regular basis, the number of hours per month, even when I go out and do things, most everything I wind up having to do by myself because other people have their lives. It's mainly that other people, if you have friends, if you're friends with bright, active people,
they have bright, active lives that sometimes intersect with yours.
Well, Anne, thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it. Bernice Pesco-Solito, what do you hear in Anne's story? It seems like one of the things she's talking about is the sort of divide between people who are married, people who have families, and people who don't.
I think you know, we know from the research that not only does loneliness affect what kinds of diseases you might experience, but it also affects how well you recover. And so what I hear in Anne's talk is the concern for, you know, having people around during periods of recovery. And we know that people post heart attack, people who've had cancer, really need this kind of strong, supportive group around them. And part of the reason for that seems to be that, you know, when we think about these kinds of social ties, we tend to think that one of the things that they do is that they provide care and love and support. But there are two other important things that these ties do that we don't think about it as much. And the first one of those is that these ties help regulate people. They oversee them. They guide them. You know, the wife nagging the husband to go to the doctor is a very important function of these kinds of close relationships. And the other thing is that they provide something to do. And what I heard here and what Anne was talking about is that is what she's missing, that there are people who are interested in the same kinds of things and have the time to engage in social interaction together and doing meaningful things. And those kinds of activities turn out to be related to biological issues like blood pressure regulation, blood sugar regulation, all the stress-related disorders, that there does seem to be a clear biological mechanism underlying these social ties. And that, you know, can affect both, you know, whether or not people get sick, but also whether or not they recover.
Joe is calling from Goochland, Virginia. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Thanks a lot for calling. What's up?
Yeah, I wanted to add maybe one deeper perspective, I think, on some of the loneliness, and I guess this is going back to the original point of having that level of trust to confide, you know, important problems with. And here's one of the factors I think might be there, and maybe you can tell me if this showed up in the research, but I think what I've noticed is because technology in general has gone up, our ability to really socialize and be more or less interesting people that you even want to get to know has gone down. So it's kind of I think, you know, to some level, people just don't have the same level of social skill and adeptness at developing those relationships, even when they have the opportunity to do it.
Mm. So as our technological fluency rises, our social fluency is atrophying, it sounds like you're saying, Joe.
Yes, I really believe that. I mean, along with some of the other factors, like
sure.
the amount of work as well.
Yeah. Well, let me put that to Jacqueline Knowles. I want to come to you, Lynn Smith-Levin, just about your research, because Joe asked if anything like that showed up in the research.
Well, from not really in our research, but research that other sociologists have done indicates that interaction over email is quite different in character from face-to-face interaction. So his speculation that we may be developing different social skills by interacting over email rather than face-to-face is pretty well-founded. We do a lot of work over email. We actually have a third co-author on this study, Matt Brashears at the University of Arizona, and I've already emailed with him six or seven times today on joint projects, but we probably won't talk face-to-face for quite a while.
Mm. Bernice Pesco-Solito, what's your take on sort of the technology? You know, we've become more technologically adept, but perhaps socially inept as time marches on.
Well, I think the real issue here is what kind of ties those interactions provide for us. The research says that, you know, these ties have to be diverse, strong, and supportive. And I'm not sure that those are the kind of ties that develop over technology. These are people who need to be there for you when you need them. You know, Lynn's question on the general social survey really is, you know, who are these people that are most important to you that you can talk to?
Mm.
And I think the really shocking finding in her research is really the isolation finding, because the 25% of Americans having nobody to talk to about deep personal issues, I think, is the key, because, again, the research shows you only really need one confidant, you know, for these health effects to be beneficial as opposed to negative. So the technology provides contact, but what kind of contact?
Hmm. I wanted, speaking of, you know, continuing this conversation about the health effects, Bernice, I wanted to ask you about this. This was new to me in the research that I was doing leading up to this hour, and that was the so-called Rosetto effect, which I'm sure you know about, and I just want to lay it out for the listeners. And this was research done in the 1960s on a small Italian immigrant community in eastern Pennsylvania, where they lived in three-generation households, centered their lives on family, and built homes so close together that neighborhoods could stay in touch with each other by walking out on the front porch. And what they found is that even though Rosetto shared the same water, hospital, doctors, as nearby towns, they had a 40% lower heart attack rate than neighboring communities. I mean, that just seemed to be an astounding support of the case you're making about this can really cause health effects.
Well, I think that, you know, when they were looking at that community, they were trying to figure out what it was. You know, was it the Mediterranean diet?
Yeah.
You know, was it the community base? And I think that we know that every community comes with its pluses and minuses. And so communities like that really do produce very, you know, healthy lifestyles for people, and that they do have those kind of connections. The problem with those kind of communities is that they're very intolerant of outsiders. And so for people who, may have more mental health problems, it can be either very supportive in that the community embraces them, or it could be very rejecting. So, you know, I understand that with regard to physical health, that those communities are really very positive. But, you know, I don't think we're going to go back to those kind of communities in general. So we've got to find a way to make the societies that we do live in more friendly and more open. And so one of the things, the research, again, shows that particularly for elderly Americans, having this supportive contact is really important. And if we go back to Anne's comment, you know, I know that, you know, people don't want to be their disease, but she talked about, you know, having to explain her situation to everybody. You know, one place that she may go that might be very helpful to her might be a breast cancer support group that would provide, she wouldn't have to explain herself, but she could talk about those kinds of situations. Or often you see programs at places like the YMCA for the elderly that really keep them in touch with sort of the community as a whole. And so you know, I know we tend to, you know, see these communities as ideal, but I don't know if we're going to be able to find that as a solution to our problems.
Interesting. Okay, Krishna is calling from Hamilton, New Jersey. Hello, Krishna.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. What's on your mind?
I was just you know, I've done a lot of work with the Maasai people in Kenya, and I use them as an example as, you know, a community that's not in the U.S. And the thing I've noticed is, you know, their identity, a Maasai person's identity, is based on the community, and your identity is in the U.S. is more individualistic, and, you know, their needs and the things they need in their society are met by the community, and here, you know, we got to sort of look for it ourselves. And I feel that, you know, in a really consumeristic, you know, society that, you know, especially in the U.S., you know, people, you know, need the new car, need the new this, need the new that. Those needs are not there, you know, in the Maasai community. And I just feel as though there's a lot of things we create in this country that, you know, it's almost, I feel, a luxury to be able to be sad because, you know, in other cultures, I feel as though they don't have those needs.
All right, Krishna, thanks for putting that on the table. Jacqueline Olds, Krishna's talking about this idea of community not getting the same value as sort of individual pursuits in this society.
Well, it couldn't be a more important point because for all we know, our march toward global warming is caused by the incredible urge for self-sufficiency in this country where we don't share cars, we don't share, you know, lawnmowers. We all have to have our own. And, you know, even when parents are buying toys for their siblings, they have to buy a toy for each sibling rather than teaching kids how to share. So there's a way in which very early in life, we Americans tend to teach people to have their own rather than share. And if we're going to save the earth, we have to share.
You know, that reminds me of some of the comments that were written in the wake of Lynn Smith Lovin's research, and that is the image of isolated people awaiting evacuation, trapped on their rooftops in New Orleans. I mean, of course, putting aside the discussion of government failure and incompetence, which we've covered and will come back to again, no doubt, you know, this was a case of people who might not have had friends that they could call and say, hey, you've got a car, get me out of here, before the floodwaters rose.
Well, I think it's partly the issue of pride, that people feel embarrassed to not be taking care of themselves all the time and act like asking a favor would be some terrible loss of pride.
Hmm. Let's go to Liz, who's calling from Boston. Hi, Liz.
Hi. I just want to say that I think it's really excellent that this research is confirming what we, the Samaritans in Boston, have known for 30 years. We're a suicide prevention agency, and our helpline gets over 80,000 calls a year from people who are isolated, despairing. Sometimes they're suicidal, but the work that we do is really early suicide prevention, which is talking to these people who are lonely. They're fully functioning. Many of our callers have jobs and work and communities, but at the end of the day, they need one person to talk to, and our volunteers can provide that.
And Liz, can you sort of summarize quickly? I mean, is there a theory among the Samaritans about why this chronic loneliness, why this epidemic of loneliness?
I mean, I think it's for different reasons, but once people feel lonely, we definitely notice that people spiral lower and lower into that loneliness, and by talking to someone, it sort of helps them get through the day.
Liz, thanks so much for that call. Jacqueline Olds, let me talk to you about the idea of mental health experts like yourself. You obviously have done a lot of thinking about this. You've written a book. But in general, do mental health experts understand how to address loneliness? I mean, is it widespread and understood?
It's certainly studied, but I don't think it's understood well enough. And I think, in fact, therapists have a slight conflict of interest because a therapist relies for their way of making a living on having people come connect with a therapist. And perhaps sometimes they don't pay enough attention to helping that person build a network and make sure that there's a ripple effect from the therapy so that they increase their social network. So psychologists and psychiatrists and social workers do pay attention to loneliness, but maybe not always in the way that helps people the most.
Interesting. Donald is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Donald, hello. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The urban theorist Jane Jacobs, who recently died, I guess, about a month ago, had a lot to say about this and how she felt that car culture had a lot to do with our isolation from each other and communities. In fact, she thought that it was really the car and not television that was leading to the decline of communities. And she talked a little bit about this in her last book, Dark Age Ahead.
It's a great point to bring up, Donald. I thank you for the call. And I'm reminded of the actor Don Cheadle in the movie Crash at the beginning. And he says people spend so much time behind their windshields that they long for human contact. And eventually all they can do is crash into each other, which is sort of one of the themes in that movie. What do you think of that, Bernice Pesco-Solito, the point that Don is making about car culture?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned Don Cheadle, because my thought was to go to Don Cheadle and his role in Hotel Rwanda, and back to the comment about the Maasai. And, you know, that idea of feeling an obligation towards one another, I think, is very important. Last week, the study came out about, you know, whether how much road rage there is, et cetera. And, you know, when we're disconnected in those little boxes, you know, the sense of obligation to one another seems to have eroded. And so people are more concerned about, you know, what's going to happen if they, you know, point out that somebody's being rude than they are about, you know, worrying about other things. So I think there is something about the fact that we are very much individually focused that produces some of these problems. And our sense of rights in America since the 1960s has really escalated and become very important to us. But our sense of obligation to one another is really what I'm more concerned about as a sociologist. You know, why don't we feel a sense of obligation toward other people, whether they're the elderly in our life or in our community?
Let's go to Susan, who's calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. One of the questions I had was whether the research has shown any parts of the United States to be friendlier places to live than others, because my family moved to suburban Boston 10 years ago, and I just find it very, very difficult to connect here.
And where did you move from, Susan?
Well, we moved actually from Europe, but I was raised in the Midwest, and we had lived in Europe for about 7 or 8 years. And I just have found that people are already very well integrated into whatever social networks that they have, that they're not really looking for new members of their group.
Yeah, it's a great question, Susan. Let me put that to our researcher, Lynn Smith-Lovin. Anything at all about sort of regional differences? Because, of course, Susan's talking about something that we hear all the time, especially in the Northeast, that places like the Midwest are in general friendlier than the Northeast. Is there anything that backs that up in the research?
It wasn't in this paper, but it's actually what we're working on right now. There are some very large regional differences that don't seem reducible to the kinds of people who live in those regions.
Hmm.
Susan's experience in the Midwest is actually fits with our data. The place where people are least likely to be socially isolated is the upper Midwest, the Dakotas, Minnesota, Iowa, Kansas, and Nebraska. And partially that's because of the kind of people they are. They tend to be well-educated, and education is very important. They tend to be white. They tend to have lived there for a long time in their communities. But not all of it can be explained by those kind of people. We find that the West is better connected than the East. And interestingly, for your Katrina example, the place that has the highest levels of social isolation is the West-South Central area, which includes Louisiana, Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas. 42% of the people in that area said that there was no one with whom they could discuss important matters.
Very interesting. Jacqueline Oles, you're nodding your head. We have about 20 seconds left, but I wanted to sort of give you a final shot at that question about regional differences and friendliness when it comes to this discussion of loneliness.
Well, I think it's probably friendliness is maybe... Well, I used to think that it was proportional to how long people had lived in one place, and that, in fact, once they were very well connected, maybe they'd be a little less likely to reach out with a welcome wagon. But, in fact, what's been said here seems to be just the opposite, that, in fact, the people who are very well connected, in fact, are friendlier. And I think it's a big problem in the East that, you know, maybe it started with so much cold weather and people being a little bit snobby, but the fact is that we need to be a friendlier society. And I have often noticed myself that if you walk down the street and smile and say hello, it sort of surprises people, but they're delighted.
Yeah. Well, let's leave it there. Our time is out. This has been a great conversation. It's made us all feel a little less lonely, I think. Lynn Smith-Lovin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Anthony.
That's Lynn Smith-Lovin, sociologist at Duke University. And Jacqueline Oles here in the studio, psychiatrist at Harvard Medical School. Thank you, Jacqueline, for coming in.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And Bernice Pesco-Solito, medical sociologist at Indiana University, joined us from West Warwick, Rhode Island. Thank you, Bernice Pesco-Solito.
Well, thank you, Anthony.
I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Call on me, brother, when you need a hand. We all need somebody.